Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, former CMS Superintendent Clayton Wilcox is accused of making racist and sexist remarks. Could that have led to his dismissal? The courts rule on North Carolina's election maps. This time, the legislature is told to redraw the congressional districts. Money continues to pour into the group promoting a yes vote on the quarter-cent sales tax hike for the arts, parks, greenways, and education. City Council delays a vote on funding for a Silver Line study, and the company building the I-77 toll lanes faces fines for delays. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those and other stories, and seated around this very table are Ann Doss Helms, reporter for WFAE News. Good morning.
Good to be here.
Joe Bruno is here. He's a reporter for WSOC TV Channel 9 Eyewitness News. Good morning.
Hi, Mike.
Your compatriot, your enemy, and partner in crime.
What?
Nick Oxner is over here.
For the record, I've known Joe since he was a freshman in college.
Okay. Nick Oxner, reporter for WETV News. And you know, Joe, they're on your side. And Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for Roll Call and a contributor to WCCB-TV News Rising. Welcome.
Good morning, Micah. Don't worry. I'm here in between to
okay,
separate
them. Yeah, WCCB is in the middle. Okay. Earlier this week, in an article made available to subscribers only, which is a topic for a whole other show, Ann. But the Charlotte Observer published some findings about former CMS Superintendent Clayton Wilcox that were heretofore unknown by most of us and possibly played a role in this mysterious dismissal he went through. What did the Observer reveal?
Well, this was fascinating to me to read because I started hearing from people about a year into his tenure. People who were very highly placed, some had left, some were still there, saying, people are really concerned about this guy and his style, and he's making these weird comments. And they were never like overt racial slurs or sexual harassment or anything, but they were these strange comments. And the Observer had more of them than I had at the time, but they were things like supposedly saying to his African-American administrative assistant, making remarks like, well, are you going to bring Pop-Tarts and Kool-Aid like you feed your kids to this potluck or, you know?
Oh, that's racist.
and giving her a little baggie and saying, keep it and let your kids put drugs in it. Mm. It's like, wait,
ouch.
What? And
yeah.
He made some joke apparently at a staff meeting about, you know, I don't want you to leak this information, so if you do, I'm going to kill you. No, I'm going to go Korean on you. No, I'm going to go North Korean on you.
Well, these, and I read all those, and these are really kind of shocking. I mean, although, off the air, he was on this program many times, and off the air, we would have conversation, and I always thought his sense of humor was kind of quirky.
It was odd.
He didn't say anything like that, but I thought, is that a joke? Or anyway.
Well, literally, the first day that when he was hired and I got him by phone, he started talking about, you know, I asked him about his Mexican heritage, and he said, yeah, on my mom's side, I don't have a Hispanic-sounding name, I don't speak Spanish, I didn't grow up in the barrio, I call myself a stealthy Mexican. And that was such a weird phrase that I actually didn't use it in the story, but apparently he kept using it, and that was one of the things cited.
So it's things like that and the things that you quoted that are surprising for their content because, in part, I think, Clayton Wilcox, during his tenure, criticized the district for failing children living in poverty. He lobbied for more funds to improve racial equity, released a report that showed wide disparities between outcomes for white and minority students that he pledged to fix. So those kinds of comments fly in the face of what he said he was trying to do.
One of the most interesting takes on that I heard from an African American woman who is very high up in CMS, and she said, and she had been talking to me about this, and the challenge that I had, and you could tell the Observer still had it, you don't like to use unnamed sources, you don't like to use secondhand. So I was always asking people, will you go on the record? Did you experience this yourself? And a lot of it was secondhand, but from very, very credible people. And nobody wanted to go on the record. But this woman who did not go on the record said, it's kind of like there are two people. Sometimes you get Mexican Clayton who genuinely identifies with these kids of color and is passionate about improving their outcomes. And sometimes you get white Clayton and he's just clueless.
Wow. Can we assume that the school board was aware of these comments at the time of his raise and extended contract and again at the time of his dismissal?
Well, at the time that his evaluation, his one-year evaluation actually took a year and a half. And so there kept being these delays, and meanwhile I'm hearing this stuff, but again, nobody's going on the record. So to me, that means you can't go use those names to the school board. But I did call a board member with whom I have a good relationship and said, I'm hearing some of this. I don't have it solid enough to do a story, but give me a heads up. Is he going to lose his job over this? And this person said, no, you know, we've heard a little bit of this, but he has this weird way of expressing himself. And then after he did lose his job 6 months later or whatever, I was talking to that same board member again, very deep background, not going on the record with anything about it. But that person said, those things you were telling me about a few months ago, they kind of bubbled up more.
Nick.
But the other important answer to your question here is this whistleblower letter complaint.
Yes.
That was the catalyst for the Observer's reporting.
That's from Brian Schultz, who was the district's chief academic officer at the time, right?
Yes, and was sent, I believe, in 2018.
Right. February of 2018, yes. So it's been out there a while.
Correct. And that letter, I'm told from my sources, included these allegations, which the Observer then took and did some additional reporting and corroborated, and was the catalyst for the first story that the Observer did on the other issues. So, and that, I think, is significant because that was someone putting their name on a letter and sending it to the school board and senior CMS officials about his boss. And the school board shrugged, I guess, at the allegation.
I think they have said that they spoke with him about it. Mary McCrae did confirm that to me and to the Observer that they spoke with him and, again, viewed it as sort of a weakness in communication or management style. They did not, you know, suspend him, did not give him a letter of reprimand. And she told me, well, we were assured it wouldn't happen again, but evidently it did.
That letter, Brian Schultz's letter, and once again, he was the district's chief academic officer at the time these allegations were made. At the time he wrote that letter, he said that Wilcox made multiple disparaging remarks about staff members and made comments that showed a lack of sensitivity to women and different cultures. Is he the only one that said that? Anybody else
corroborated
that?
I think the Observer referred to two whistleblower letters. Okay. And I don't, they must
well,
not
one
have
one letter
other,
and two other people that, two other people whistleblowers that had reported.
I thought there was.
But it also, the letter also detailed.
At least two senior administrators to send whistleblower complaint letters.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
I think there's another letter that they don't have. I don't have these letters.
It's going to sound like an insensitive question, but I think it has to be asked. He did have a sense of humor, and you quoted some lines that I'm thinking he meant in humor. Could it just be a misaligned sense of humor, a mistaken sense of humor, a bad judgment in using a sense of humor?
Well, I think that's the reason that you know, you don't end a guy's career over something that could have been a misunderstanding. But the interesting thing is he was really pushing for cultural competence training for teachers, for principals.
Maybe he wanted it.
And one of the big lessons from that is that those of us who are in the dominant culture who tend to have the power tend to think my intentions are what matter.
Yeah.
You know, if I didn't intend to offend you, you can't be offended.
Right.
If I say that I'm not a racist or a sexist, you can't call me that. And I think one of the big things that you learn in that training is, no, it's not just about your intentions. It's about how they're received, and you need to think about how they're received.
So, Mary, you've been sitting here very quietly, but I'm looking at your face.
Yes.
Thoughts?
Well, no. I just thinking that in a majority, you have so many minority kids in the system, and teachers that have to deal with them day to day, and a lot of the teachers are white teachers. And as someone who has had a child in the system, and these things are important, how teachers interact with their students, how administrators interact. It's not just what you say. It's the unconscious bias that comes with some of those remarks. It's how the kids feel when they come into the classroom, if they are feel that they can achieve, if they are feel that they are the potential for being in the gifted classes. These things seep into it. And I just think that for someone who is the leader, they have to demonstrate the policies that they want to see. And I was talking about this earlier with Ann, that, you know, for a system as big and prominent as Charlotte-Mecklenburg system, how are we recruiting people? Who are we getting? You know, how much is the public having input in, the teachers having input in it? And when you see these comments come out, you do think, is this the best that we can do?
Yeah. The school system's policy administrator and former Republican lawmaker Charles Jeter told WBTV the newly created Office of Compliance and Transparency at CMS would help clamp down in the future on this kind of behavior that's alleged about Wilcox.
I think it's fair to say that some of the recent criticism and that kind of stuff has played some part of it. And we think it's a great practice moving forward so that people can actually see and understand we're doing everything we can to make sure the public has all the information we can give them.
What does that mean? I mean, if the district has this Office of Compliance and Transparency, why are we just hearing about this now? The first letter came out in February 2018. What kind of transparency is that?
And Chandler's article also points out that they're refusing to release the letter, citing a provision of the law that doesn't apply to this letter. And so you can't claim to be transparent in one breath and in the same breath say we're not going to give you this document that should be public under the law.
And that can be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they. You know, you could argue that they're really laying out a case that this office is sorely needed because the transparency has been lacking.
But they're not transparent. If they'd been transparent, we would have known about this without the observer's help.
Yeah, and to some extent, you know, you don't go read a whistleblower letter out loud at a school board meeting. There is some level of confidentiality that is needed until you decide this is the person. We can't work with him. We need to get rid of him. But then you do feel like the employees, I mean, you're talking about 19,000 some employees, and some of whom really felt good about him and were devastated to hear he was being pushed out.
There is a school board election going on.
There is.
Yes, there are three people up, at large seats up. What does this say? Because you've covered this for years, and you know everybody on the school board. What does this operational method that we've been talking about now for months since Clayton Wilcox was fired, in fact, since Heath Morrison was fired,
right,
secretly, we still don't know why. What does this say about these people, or is it simply the operational system that they're working under and laws that they have to conform with that over which they have no control?
Well, there are some laws, and I think what this current CMS leadership would say is we were dealt some really bad hands. We played them the best we could.
They were dealt because of the people they chose?
There is that, yes.
And don't forget, they had this whistleblower letter that not only alleged this racial and potentially racist and sexist comments, but also the allegations of self-dealing, right, and steering contracts to his family members. They had these allegations in their hand when they voted to give the man a raise. And so I think, you know, you don't have to read the whistleblower letter out loud to the public, but you don't have to give the guy a raise either. And that calls into question.
In Brian Schultz's letter, once again, he's the whistleblower. He wrote, quote, "I am both embarrassed and shocked that I feel compelled to report my concerns of a veteran educator who has led multiple districts. To say that he should know better is a huge understatement. When Clayton Wilcox's predecessor, Heath Morrison, was dismissed, although we've never received an official explanation for that dismissal from the school board either, there were rumors at the time that he was a kind of a tyrant who made some hateful statements to staff members. Those actions bear some similarity to these accusations against Clayton Wilcox. Does this speak to what Mary just talked about, and that is to their vetting process?
I think it does. And I think there was a lot of concern, especially going into the search that led to Clayton Wilcox's hiring. You know, you had had a search that led to a prominent dismissal. You had sort of an effort to hire Mo Green, and then he took a different job. You had all this tension over, we have Ann Clark here. Some board members thought we'd be fools not to keep her. They may be saying, I told you so now. Some of them thought we needed to do another search. And there was a lot of speculation at the time about what quality of candidates are we getting? And then they said, well, guess what? You all aren't going to meet them. That doesn't really contribute anything. We didn't actually fly out to talk to people.
Meet them?
Yeah, he came in and he talked to board members.
He didn't make many jokes during that interview.
You know, and one thing that was not a joke in here that I think to me is something that really stood out from Brian Schultz's letter was the thing where he supposedly made reference to a woman, a district administrator, and said, well, she's not going to get anywhere here because she's suing over pay disparities.
Okay, a couple more questions about this, and then we move on to other things. Because there was other news, including redrawing the congressional district maps in North Carolina and the sales tax hike and the progress on that. Be Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Mary C. Curtis is here from WCCB-TV and Roll Call. Nick Oxner from WBTV News. Joe Bruno from WSSC-TV News. And Ann Doss-Helms from WFAE and Facebook TV News, because we're on Facebook this morning. All right, a couple more questions about the Clayton Wilcox situation. The current superintendent, Ernest Winston, worked previously as the district's ombudsman, which means he heard complaints from people and tried to work through problems that the district confronted. Would complaints like these have been filtered through him?
I believe the Observer article said that he did hear some of them, and he advised some employees about either going to school board members or to the legal department. And I don't know what role the Human Resources Department plays in all this either. That's been kind of a perpetual struggle for CMS to find the right person to handle human resources. They've got a new person in now.
He told the Observer that some staff members did complain about these alleged comments, but he has refused to provide details, saying that the conversations were, are you ready for this? Confidential. I could see how they would be confidential during Clayton Wilcox's tenure as superintendent, but he's no longer there, and he was fired mysteriously, and we've never been told why. So why would those comments be confidential today?
Well, I think if the person talking to you asks for confidentiality, it probably is granted until they revoke it. And that's been an interesting thing, is that even when people left the district, except for Brian Schultz, and I believe he wrote his whistleblower letter on the way out the door, there are people who have left, and that's been one of the concerns, is that there have been a lot of people leaving. They have not come forward and said, now that I'm out the door, I'm going to say this about him. Once he left, we have not had people come forward. I know that Annie Ma and Fred Kelly were working their tails off to get people on the record with names in this article. And evidently, there's just a sense that you don't badmouth another high-level educator.
They are the two reporters who reported this story for the Charlotte Observer. After Heath Morrison quickly exited the superintendent's position, some school system employees, you reported on this when you were at the Observer, described a culture of fear during Heath Morrison's tenure. Now, some are referring to the culture during Wilcox's tenure as dangerous, a dangerous culture. What are we to take from this? Who are they hiring over there?
Yeah, and again, this goes back to the comment I was referring to when we had to cut to the break. I heard again from people who were not on the record but were very credible that he would badmouth employees to other employees, kind of like this remark about this person's pay disparities, that he would, if he got bad publicity, he would start pointing the finger at other people. So all of those are... That's not a bad sense of humor. That's a real management culture thing. Now, again, I can't swear that that's true,
well,
but
that's
serious.
Let me just ask you this, because Heath Morrison came in, and he was the darling of the education world, and everybody said he was the best thing since sliced bread, and he was charged with making changes in the culture. So was Clayton Wilcox.
Yeah.
Could this be stemming from the fact that people don't like change, therefore they don't like the person charged with implementing change, and they find a way to complain about the change through complaining about that person's style, culture of fear, culture of danger, that they perceive because they don't like the change?
Well, and that is always one of the challenges that as a reporter, and I think probably as board members, you have to ask. There's always somebody who doesn't like the new leader. There's always is some resistance. But at the point that you have two of them who end up getting pushed out for essentially what you figure they would have lost if they had tried to hold on to their jobs, they would have been fired. At some point, you realize, no, this was not just a little bit of friction.
Okay, moving on. Another court ruling about North Carolina's election maps came down this week when a panel of three state judges said the state cannot use the current congressional districts as drawn for the 2020 election, even as the lawsuit surrounding those districts continues to proceed. This will impact the March primary, which is coming up right around the corner. But remind us where we stand on all of these districts and lawsuits, both congressional and legislative. You have your hands going back and forth. Go ahead, Nick.
You spoke with a lot of certainty in a very uncertain ruling.
Yes.
So let's start with a different ruling from the same three-judge panel that came down literally minutes before the congressional one you're talking about. And that ruling was in a different case challenging state legislative maps that three-judge panel had a trial and ruled had to be redrawn, had to be redrawn quickly and publicly. And to everyone's surprise, the General Assembly was able to draw maps quickly and publicly, and the three-judge panel in the state legislative district's case said, these maps are fine. Well done. So then literally 3 minutes later, while all of us are reading the ruling from the first case, they send out this new order in the second case challenging North Carolina's congressional district. U.S. congressional maps in a new case, and they put in a temporary, a preliminary injunction, which says, we don't know if you're going to be able to use these maps or not, but until we make a decision, don't plan on using them and don't make any preparations for the March 2020 primary. And they noted in their ruling, they said, look, we know we need to do this quickly. We're going to rule on what's called summary judgment, so kind of getting to a decision without having a trial but hearing some facts as quickly as we can. And they noted, we feel confident that we might be able to get this all done before the March filing deadline because the General Assembly just did such a good and quick job in the last case we just ruled on. And so that's where
we are.
And
if you want some more complications,
well,
you know that the Supreme Court ruled that partisan gerrymandering was fine. And so some folks thought, well, okay, then we're out of it. Our congressional districts will
Wait
stand.
A minute. I don't think they ruled that the partisan gerrymandering was fine.
Well,
they ruled that they had
it
no
was
place,
up to the—
They had no
yes,
place to make the
decision. They had no place to make the decision, right? But then folks brought the suits in the state, which is possible because of the North Carolina state constitution.
Right.
And our state court, of course, is a majority of Democratic judges. And so, yes, they felt that this could go through. That
this was a three-judge panel. Two of them were Democrats. One was Republican, but it was a unanimous decision, correct?
Yeah, all of the three-judge panel's rulings have been unanimous.
Yeah.
Okay,
and so,
how might this impact the 2020 judges?
Well, filing opens in one month and one day, December 7th.
Okay.
In that ruling, that kind of vague ruling, it did note that, you know, delaying the primary could, you know, reduce voter turnout and increase the costs, but those consequences pale in comparison to voters of our state proceeding to vote yet again in congressional elections administered pursuant to maps drawn in violation of our North Carolina Constitution.
But do we even know what we're voting for? Who was in what district? What the district looks like?
Well,
what district I live in? That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's part of why you need clarity before March 3rd.
Well, before the
before December 2nd.
Before the filing.
I mean, you've got Alma Adams saying she's going to file for this for Charlotte no matter what.
Even though she is, her home district was the Greensboro area. Right.
Yesterday, a Republican group asked a federal court to allow North Carolina to use these maps that were struck down for the 2020 election, citing in part because of all this confusion.
So, of course, the opinions about this most recent court ruling about maps is breaking down along party lines. Opinion about it is. Republican Phil Berger, the state Senate leader, believes the courts should stay out of this matter.
It's one of the worst things that can happen to our system of government is for folks like these judges to make these kinds of policy decisions behind closed doors with no real oversight as far as the people is concerned.
Well, were the people involved in drawing these maps when the Republicans drew these maps?
No, and they weren't when the Democrats drew the maps either. It is interesting. The court in issuing this preliminary injunction said, we don't really have the authority to tell a co-equal branch of government exactly what to do without finding some unconstitutional thing. But yesterday, leaders in the legislature, Republican leaders in the legislature, said, you know what? We might just go ahead and examine the possibility of drawing some maps now before any new maps before anyone else tells us to.
Hmm. And well, you know, in the past, though, you know, we have 10-3 Republican majority in the House delegation in a state that's 50-50 pretty much. And so we've gone around and around on these maps. So, you know, the people who drew them said they drew them purposely so that the Republicans would have the advantage. So we are going to keep going around with this as long as there are folks who are going to be suing, saying I'm not being represented by these, you know, cracked and packed districts.
If they do redraw maps, I think you have to look at Asheville when you got Mark Meadows and McHenry kind of splitting that area. Then you also have Ted Budd up in Greensboro with Mark Walker, and I also think the 9th district is probably one of those districts.
The way they have the historically black college, North Carolina A&T, the campus split in two is pretty outrageous.
So Democratic State Senator from Durham, Mike Woodard, of course disagrees with Republican Phil Berger, and he says the courts provided the only option for fairness.
These maps are unfair, and that we need to stop the gerrymandering, be it racial gerrymandering or political gerrymandering. It's time to fix it. We'll go to the courts because they have been the fair arbiters.
So meanwhile, as you already mentioned, Democrat Alma Adams, who represents the 12th Congressional District in Mecklenburg County in the House, in the U.S. House, says that she will run for re-election in 2020, even if a new Democratic-friendly district is created in her home, which is, of course, the Triad. She serves in Mel Watts' old district. That's, and she moved from
Move is a loose term.
Well, she moved allegedly moved from Greensboro to Charlotte after...
She has an address here.
Yeah, she has an address here.
She does, and yet...
But this new district is... The district has since been redrawn since she first ran, and it now encompasses only Mecklenburg County. Does this settle the question that she moved here?
No.
No.
So Mike, you'll recall this first came up in, was it 2016?
Yes.
In the 2016 primary, when her district had first been redrawn, and used to stretch, right up 85.
Right, to Greensboro.
In a district originally drawn by Democrats and continued to be gerrymandered by Republicans. And this question came up. She said she had moved to Charlotte. And yet I found her pulling into the driveway of her Greensboro home that year, and she drove away from me when I tried to talk to her.
She almost hit you, didn't she?
Yeah, she biffed the curb. I don't think it was intentional. She scrubbed all the references to Greensboro off her website back then. And ever since, I think she's never fully answered the question, do you actually live? She was very proud to tell me, in an interview the next day, that she lived in Fourth Ward. And I wondered if I asked her where that was, if she could answer it.
But they aren't required to live in the district.
They are not
right?
required. Which raises the question of why won't she just say, I live in Greensboro, and it doesn't matter.
Yeah, we've seen these dynamics sometimes with local races where you are required to live in the district, and there are allegations that somebody is just renting an apartment there.
Now, Watt didn't live in his district.
The biggest issue on the November ballot here in Mecklenburg County, at least, and one on every iteration of the ballot in Mecklenburg County, is the proposal to raise the sales tax by a quarter cent to support the Arts and Science Council, parks, greenways, and education. There's some very big money flowing into this effort, at least on the side of those in favor of this tax hike. How much have they raised?
More than $800,000 compared to, what was it, $1,500 for the opposition?
Yeah. Yeah. Could the sums of money that are being raised on either side of this issue be predictive of the outcome of the vote?
It's a lot of corporate donations, and I don't know if that necessarily will be predictive of the outcome of the vote.
So how is this money being spent, all this money that they're raising?
A lot of mail, I can tell you that, because I get it every single day. What's interesting, though, is the most recent piece of mail that came in my mailbox mentioned education, and it mentioned parks. It did not mention the Arts and Science Council.
I hold in my never nicotine-stained hand.
That's not a good prop for radio, Mike.
But they're all now going to Facebook Live quickly to see you waving the brochure.
It's a mailer. It's a double-sided, thick paper.
Yeah, a lot of colors mailer. On the mailer, too.
And it's headlined, Vote for Investment in Our Public Schools and Our Parks. And it goes on to list higher teacher pay, restored class field trips, and rejuvenated parks and expanded greenways as the outcome of a yes vote on this referendum. But the arts will get the biggest portion of this money. Was this an omission, an oversight?
There are some people speculating that the reason they are doing it this way is because polling for the arts and science portion of the tax must not be good, but polling for the parks and education aspects of it might increase support for it.
We held a Charlotte Talks forum on this topic this week from the McGlone Theater here at Spirit Square with representatives of both sides on the stage, and I asked the two proponents of this about that aspect of their advertising, both in mail and on television. And I asked County Commissioner Susan Harden, who's in favor of this, about this. She's in favor. I asked her if the advertising is being honest with voters.
Well, you should know that a big portion of that cultural funding is to return field trips to our schools and to provide arts
but
programming.
But 45% of it's going to the arts. Are you being honest in your presentation of this issue?
I hope we're being honest. I mean, we
How
absolutely...
How are you?
Because education, we want to bring to the forefront also the benefits that this is going to provide for teachers and for parks. We want to bring that to the forefront because arts has been such a strong portion of that. But really the transformational, the shot in the arm this is going to mean for teachers to have a designated funding stream every year that will be provided for teacher assistants, school counselors, school psychologists.
So the ASC, the Arts and Science Council, asked for this tax hike, and they recommended the proceeds be split among other interests because they can't use, they say, the $50 million the tax will produce. But in 2014, A similar issue was put to a referendum by the voters, with the bulk of the money at that time going to education and the minority of the money at that time going to the arts. It lost. The voters said no. Given that, is this current approach the right one?
In 2014, though, they didn't have this coordinated campaign, so they're investing a lot more money on it now. They're educating voters about it.
Well, let me ask you, are they educating voters about it? Are they being honest?
Not fully.
I think there's a lot of confusion about what some of this means, because there is the education chunk that's 16% or about $8 million. But then she says things like restore field trips. And I had people asking me, wait, does that mean CMS has eliminated field trips?
I was going to ask you about that, because every day we see kids walking up the street here outside this window to Discovery Place. Every day almost there are school buses piled around Imaginum, which is the home of the children's theater. Almost every day. Are they not field trips? Are they just parking the buses there because they got no place to park them?
Well, and I have asked CMS to clarify some of these things. There have also been, I think, one of the county commissioners, Bill Malik, has talked about restoring music to the schools, you know.
Has that been cut?
Well, I asked them, clarify for me what you used to have, what this would fill in. I know they don't want to get involved in a political issue, and I know to a certain extent they don't know, because I think when they talk about things like music and field trips, they're talking about arts organizations that would partner with CMS. But they are creating confusion. There are people who legitimately are asking, have they eliminated all of this? And it would be lovely if CMS would answer that. I literally called two people in the public information office yesterday and said, please give me some clarity about how this is going to play out. And I didn't get any response.
Why not?
Maybe they're waiting for the Office of Transparency.
Okay, so 45% or $22.5 million is scheduled to go to the arts, 34% or $17 million to parks and greenways, 16% or $8 million to education, an additional 5% or $2.5 million to towns. Commissioner Pat Cotham, also on our panel at McGlohan this week, she's opposed to the tax for a number of reasons, including other pressing needs, but she pointed out that there are no guarantees that the money will be used for the purposes they were advertising it for, and she's also concerned that the mechanism to govern the distribution of the arts portion of this is still up in the air. She compared this election process to telling the voters to either vote for a Republican or a Democrat, and once they do, then we'll tell you who the candidate is. We'll come back and ask one more question about this and move on to the state budget and other things in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Hey, y'all, this is Tommy Tomlinson. On this week's episode of Southbound, we talked to Mitch Landrieu, the former mayor of New Orleans, who spent the last year talking to people about the segregation and inequality that haunt the South and what we can do about it. You can find this and every episode of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, and WFAE.org.
Support for Southbound comes from Southeast Radiation Oncology Group.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Ann Doss Helms is here, education reporter for WFAE News. Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call, contributor to WCCB-TV News Rising. Nick Oxner from WBTV News. And Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV News. One final question. We just talked about Pat Cotham, who was on our panel. She is against this, and she's a county commissioner. All the people on county commission are Democrats. And this is making strange bedfellows of Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives, because both are on both sides of this issue. But the fact that arts is not on this flyer, the fact that the major TV commercial that I keep seeing run over and over and over again talks about field trips and parks and nary a mention of the arts when the bulk of the money is going to the arts, do you think people going into the voting booth will know any of this? Because this referendum is worded this way: local sales and use tax at the rate of 0.25%, in addition to all other state and local sales and use taxes, and you're asked to vote for or against. No mention of any of this. Do you think people going into the voting booth, and they're expecting, what, a 15% turnout, are going to know any of this?
I think there will be a lot of uninformed people walking in. I think those of us who are in the thick of this think everybody in the world is talking about the sales tax referendum, and there will be people who will walk in and go, do I want to pay more sales tax? Well, no.
Okay. And plus 15% of people are scheduled to vote for this. So 15% of the voters are making a very big decision.
And I don't think people will know that this is the final quarter cent sales tax increase at Mecklenburg.
Yeah, once they do this, they can't do it again.
Right, ever. Without the General Assembly's right. permission.
Plus, there, as Pat Cotham says, there's no guarantee that the future county commission won't take that money and say, well, we got a better use for this.
Right.
Okay, last month, House Speaker Tim Moore was said by Democrats to have pulled a fast one on them by holding a vote to override Governor Roy Cooper's budget veto at a time when Democrats were not present. That House vote was in favor of overriding the governor's veto. Only one Senate Democrat is necessary to accomplish that vote in the Senate, and Republicans there wanted to try that on Monday. They postponed the vote to Wednesday. What happened?
Well, nothing happened because they don't have the votes.
They went home yesterday, right?
For a couple weeks. They went home long enough to be able to legally raise funds from certain groups that they can't raise money from when they're in session. That's really what this is about. I guess his credit, Phil Berger has said, without saying these exact words, I said, I'm not going to do what Tim Moore did and seize upon, good timing to ram something through. And so he said that, you know, they're either going to take the vote or they're not going to take the vote. So far, they've not taken the vote.
So Phil Berger has said that the Senate would attempt to advance additional mini budgets. These are separate bills containing popular sections of the vetoed budget. And the governor has been signing these mini budgets since they started in August. So is he signing these for political purposes because these measures are popular, or because these are the portions of the budget that both Republicans and Democrats agree on?
Well, so and they agree on almost everything
but Medicaid.
That's the one sticking point. So everything else in here is actually the result of a lot of lobbying, a lot of deal making, what have you. Yesterday, Berger's office sent out a press release that said they have passed 98.5% of the budget through these mini budgets, which I thought was very interesting that it was that large, right? And basically everything but Medicaid and teachers. I mean,
and now they do have a mini budget for teachers.
Yes, and it's and the raises are what
3.9% for teachers. The Republicans had come in and said, if you Democrats will help vote to override his veto of the budget, we'll go up to 4.4% for teachers over 2 years.
And the governor doesn't like it because the governor wants more money for teachers. Is more money for teachers in the real budget?
No, so this would be a raise on the mini budget, and the raises Angus was referring to would be total in addition to what's in the budget. There is a raise for teachers of like 1.7%, 2%, something. It's not very big in the budget that's been vetoed and stalemate. And the Republicans in the General Assembly have continued to give teachers pay raises over the last few years, but it's very small compared to raises they've given other state employees. Last year, they instituted a $15 minimum wage.
And so far, they've gotten nothing, not even the experience right. raises. And I think that's sort of the dynamic now is if he doesn't sign it, they go even longer with nothing. So there's going to be Republicans pointing to Roy Cooper. I don't know whether teachers will buy into that or not.
This is all politics.
It is.
Okay. All right. Charlotte City Council has said yes this week to funds for additional construction at the airport. They approved $518 million in contracts for a $600 million expansion of the lobby and security checkpoints and more. But they decided to postpone a decision on whether to spend $50 million on a study to find out what the Silver Line light rail line expansion from Matthews to Melmont might cost. They put that decision off until November the 12th. Joe, why?
Well, the city manager met with council members individually, gauged where they are on this issue. And one thing that he found was everybody was asking, or most council members were asking the same question. How are we going to pay for the Silver Line? What options do we have? So that was the major reason why they postponed it. The timing is interesting because they postponed it until after voters will decide whether to increase the quarter cent sales tax.
And that was deliberate, wasn't it?
Yes,
they want to keep their eye on what the voters say.
They want to know what voters say here, and they want to know if that will be an option for the Silver Line potentially. in the future. And there are some council members who believe that the Silver Line may not even be feasible without that quarter-cent sales tax.
Well, the Silver Line, we think, well, first of all, 1 year of the sales tax would pay for the study,
$50 million. Yeah.
But after that, if they decide, if the study says, here's the route we'll take, here's what it will cost, it's going to cost billions of dollars.
The CAT CEO estimated about $3 to $4 billion, using the Blue Line extension cost estimates of $125 million per mile.
So when they say they're keeping a close eye on the referendum and the results of the referendum, are they trying to measure the temperature of the public, or are they looking at this simply as a possible revenue source if the public says no to this sales tax hike?
I believe both. I think that the CAT CEO said sales tax is something that could be leveraged in the future for the Silver Line, but he also mentioned property tax as a route and public-private partnerships. But you got to keep in mind, if the quarter-cent sales tax is an option, then you got to make up that money somewhere, and that could be an even larger property tax increase in the future.
And isn't this it's the federal government, the state government, everybody's going to have to
weigh. We're assuming the federal government will provide 50% and the state will provide 25%, and then the city would be on the hook for about $1 billion, the other 25%.
So we won't know exactly what all of this costs, because they have to do the study first, and even then that number will not be precisely
correct
until they actually build it. And here's something else no one knows. When will the construction on I-77's toll lanes be complete? It was supposed to be finished last December. They extended the deadline to today. And as anybody who rides on I-77 knows, they ain't done. And DOT has refused to extend the deadline for opening the lanes yet again. And so, beginning today, the company is getting fined. How much?
$30,000. So $10,000 per unfinished section. There are three unfinished sections.
Per day.
Per day. That includes weekends.
That's a lot of money to me. So put that into perspective to a company like Sintra.
Well, the $30,000 per day is on top of all the other fines that they've already accrued for other issues that they've had with the project. And my estimate is at $6.5 million. And to give you some perspective, last year I did a story on the amount of fines that highway projects across our area are receiving. So $6.5 million for I-77 tolls as of now. As of last year, the Monroe Expressway had only been fined $135,000, and the I-85 widening project in Kannapolis was only fined $54,000. So that's a pretty big difference.
What's been the problem here?
For the most part, Sintra's major issue has been opening portions of the highway on time.
Why?
Because occasionally a dump truck will drive into a bridge with its bed up and shut down the highway because the truck will overturn and they have to remove it. A contractor will pull down construction lines and they'll have to close the highway because they have to remove the debris.
Is this just accidents or is this incompetent management?
Well, Sintra has a history of poor projections. I mean, poor ridership projections, poor construction projections.
And a lot of the roads that they have opened in other parts of the country they pulled out of it because they've gone bankrupt.
They end up going bankrupt and having to sell the rights to toll them. They did that in the Chicago Skyway, the Indiana Toll Road. They built a road in Texas that no one drove on and has since gone bankrupt and back to the state. But Sintra gets all the financing that you can take advantage of as a private company, and they do this on these projections, be it their construction timeline or their ridership projections. And historically, if you look at their projects, they're just not true, and they're based on a number of factors that don't exist anymore.
We knew this going in, or we didn't do due diligence?
It was very readily apparent going in, and it got pushed through.
Yes, it seemed urgent, and we had to do it. Every time I asked a politician why, we have to do it.
Well, and as Roy Cooper is finding out the hard way, Pat McCrory, who was a very big proponent, and Phil Berger, a big proponent of the toll road, knew as soon as you sign the contract to get it in motion, it's very hard to undo later.
So there have been – go ahead.
I would just like to say it's $6.15 million in total fines, not 6.5. Just a quick correction there. But also I think from a political standpoint, Governor Cooper's Department of Transportation, they really had no choice. They had to find Sintra. I can envision Dan Forrest's ads right now. Cooper said he would cancel the tolling project. He granted them two extensions. So this was something that the Department of Transportation probably felt like they had to do.
And more recently, when Cooper was in town, he said, we're trying to get back more ownership of the lanes. He knows is the thing he needs to do, but you functionally can't without spending millions and millions.
So $6.15 million in fines incurred by Sintra and I-77 Mobility Partners. Sintra is the parent company out of Spain. And then there are about $150 million in overruns, bringing the total cost so far to $800 million. Can we expect tolls to rise as a result of this?
I think so. But for now, they won't, because they're in that guaranteed price range. But then when the full lanes open and they go to that dynamic pricing, who knows how
high they'll exact get. Same thing that happened on the Chicago Skyway and Indiana Toll Road, is their ridership projections weren't meeting what they thought. So they kept raising the rates. The ridership actually continued going down, and it was a bad.
And they can
trend.
Get $75 million more from the state if they don't hit their revenue projections.
A couple of more quick questions about schools. Today kicks off the 2020 school choice season in Charlotte-Mecklenburg, which always seems to be confusing and somewhat overwhelming for parents. What is this all about, and why isn't, after all these years, why isn't this process smoother?
Well, I don't know that it's not smooth so much as it is large and complicated. The number of charter schools keeps increasing. CMS keeps responding by opening more magnets, putting them in different locations. And meanwhile, enrollment is leveling out. So I think that the competition becomes even more intense, because just as we have extremely high demand charter schools and extremely overfilled CMS schools, we have some that are struggling to fill.
And how long do parents have to make a decision?
I believe the CMS application period runs through December 13th.
Okay.
And again, charter schools, different districts, all have different dates. So that's part of the confusion.
And Tuesday marked the one-year anniversary of the student shooting at Butler High School, in which a 16-year-old student, Bobby McKeithen, was fatally shot outside the school cafeteria by his 16-year-old classmate, Jatwan Cuffey, who is now serving time for voluntary manslaughter. How did the school observe the day?
I don't know any details. They made a point of sending out a release saying, we want this to be private. We are going to keep the media out.
Well, politics is invading North and South Carolina. The pilgrimages of Democratic presidential candidates to our region continues. Next week, frontrunner Elizabeth Warren pays a visit to Raleigh. Joe Biden held a campaign event last weekend in Durham. And Pete Buttigieg was in Rock Hill last weekend and stressed his moderate bona fides. He said, every single time in the last 50 years or so that Democrats have won the Oval Office, and I mean every single time, it's been a candidate who hasn't been on the scene very long, wasn't perceived as a creature of Washington, called the country to its highest values, and represented a new generation of American leadership. It's how we win, he said. Mary, you interviewed him last Saturday.
Yes, I did. He's trying to place himself in that moderate lane if Joe Biden, perhaps, who's been placing himself there, drops out. And we've seen he's doing really well in Iowa. He's going there this weekend again.
He's third.
Yes, the latest poll has him third, and his campaign coffers are full. And Biden has had some problems fundraising. But in South Carolina, where he spent the weekend, this past weekend, he is lagging behind in the single digits, primarily, I think, because folks don't know him, but the majority of the Democratic electorate is African-American, and he has had trouble nationally breaking through. That's why you saw him speaking at an AME Zion worship service at a tailgate at a historically black college. And when I spoke with him, he brought a couple of surrogates, black women from South Bend, to talk about what he's done there, because there are questions about his role with the minority community there as far as policing is concerned.
Which is the more important, the minority concerns about policing in his hometown of South Bend, Indiana, where there have been problems that he kind of didn't handle, or his sexuality?
Well, I wouldn't say that there's a top tier or a bottom tier. I think that there was a bit of a backlash because there was a leak, his campaign said it wasn't from them, of a very small focus group of 20-some folks, and it said that some folks had, African-Americans had problems with his sexuality. But what I hear more is you have these great plans, the Douglas plan about criminal justice and so forth. How can we trust you to implement them on a national level where you have had some problems? And a sense that, you know, as far as the African-American community is concerned, their issues with homosexuality is similar to any other. So it seems like placing the onus on them if his numbers are low. So they just need to he needs to get his face out there to talk to people.
We would be remiss if we did not mention Kay Hagan today. A former North Carolina U.S. Senator, Kay Hagan, died this week. She was elected in 2008 as the state's first Democratic senator, female senator, when she beat Republican Elizabeth Dole, and then she lost her seat, of course, to Tom Tillis in 2014 in a very close contest. How will she be remembered?
I mean, she was a pleasure to cover. She was really a pleasure to cover. Very nicely.
Republican Senator Richard Burr said she will be remembered for her tireless work on behalf of the people she loved, Barack Obama. As president, I deeply appreciated her reasoned, pragmatic voice. We're all better off because of her. And Senator Tom Tillis said he was heartbroken by her passing.
She did walk across the aisle.
Mary C. Curtis, Nick Oxner, Joe Bruno, and Doss Helms. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.